Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Jimmy Gownley, and we're going to be looking at Peanuts 1953 here on Unpacking Peanuts today. It's a big year for Charles Schulz and the gang. Joining me as always, he's a composer for the band Complicated People, as well as this very podcast that you're listening to right now. And he's the cartoonist behind such great strips as Strange Attractors, A Gathering of Spells, and Tangled River, Michael Cohen.
Hello there.
And also my other co-host, this is exciting. I don't know if you guys are familiar with a little show called Mystery Science Theater 3000. Well, he was the executive producer and writer on MST3K. Vice President of Archie Comics and creator of the wonderful Instagram strip Sweetest Beasts, Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
And I'm Jimmy Gownley. You don't know me. If you know me, it's from a book called Amelia Rules, or my memoir, Dumbest Idea Ever. And my new book from Scholastic is out right now called Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up. And the three of us are going to take you on a little journey through the Peanuts world of 1953. But guys, before we start, I have an exciting thing, a little present for you guys. I did some extra research. I have the etymology and definition of the word fuss budget. Now,
someone's done his homework.
I'm very excited about this. Do either of you want to guess? Did Charles Schulz create this word or not? Any bettors?
I think not.
I'd say no.
That is correct. He did not. Earliest usage is 1904. Okay. Huh. This is according to an article in Deseret News, which is a Salt Lake City newspaper, and an interview with the editors of Merriam-Webster.com, I guess. So there is some controversy about fuss budget, but 1904 is its earliest appearance. Fuss, we all understand that, you know, to complain, to whine, to make a stink about something. But budget comes from, there is apparently a regional Appalachian definition of the word budget, which actually means bundle. So a fuss budget is someone who is a bundle of complaints.
That's fascinating.
So there you go. So why Schulz had that word, it must have come from someone in his family, I guess. In the back of his head, but he applied it to Lucy, and now we know, 1904, a bundle of complaints.
I wonder when it was used the most. Like, oh, wait, actually, I pulled this up on the Google Books Ngram viewer. Now this is going to really cause us trouble. This is going to turn our heads. We don't know what to do with this. The word fuss budget. Have you used this thing before on Google? It's like,
I don't know what you're
Google,
talking about.
So Google Books has scanned.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of books, and it's all obviously now in their database. So they have this little thing where you can plug in a particular word and see how often it was used relative year to year from like 1800 to today. And I just plugged it in while you were saying this, and this shows that the first use of the word goat dates back to like 1850 something.
Well, why don't you do your own damn research next time? All over
well, what do you think I'm doing here? Well, I'm doing it on the fly.
Be a fuss budget. Did you just actually me? Right on my own part? Actually.
It's actually derived from the Latin fuxix budgetus.
So that is the last time I will be doing any research.
Oh, no, no, no. Look what you started, Jim. You just opened up a whole world of research to all of us.
You do not.
You are a catalyst.
In the presence of Harold Buchholz.
You are a catalyst. No, I will share it peaked out by far. It was super popular, according to this thing, in the late 20s and early 30s. So how old would Schulz have been? He would have been like,
he was born in the 20s. So
he himself may have been
1922, because this is his 100th.
Well, that would, because I mean, like, peaks way out. Like it's like nothing in until it's like three or four or five times the usage for this little brief period of like late 1920s, early 1930s. And then for some reason it peaked again in like 2015. Someone must have brought it back.
Someone brought it back. Bring
it
back.
Put it in a song or something. Right. So sorry to step on you, but you just inspired me to look that up while we were talking, and I'd forgotten. Right,
so that is that Harold's reason. First, actually, of the podcast. So. If you have an actually, you could leave it somewhere on the internet. Perhaps that Scream Into the Void website. That'd be a good place to leave it. So listen, guys, you know, before we go into the details and the depths of 1953, I want to talk about things from a little bit of a different approach. I've been reading a lot of comic book criticism lately, and I've noticed, not comic book, but comics criticism lately, and I've noticed that there is sort of a, if I could be so bold, a downturn in the level of discourse. While comics are extremely popular right now, particularly with the success of things like Dog Man or whatever. I mean, there are kids who are reading comics by the millions. When you read the reviews and when you read people's reaction to these things, it's coming from a place that does not have a great knowledge of how a comic works. What I mean by that is they seem to talk about the words and they talk about the characters as if they're real people. And that's the extent of it. There's no real talk about the way, if the art is mentioned at all, it's to call it, you know, cute or fun or colorful or whatever, without any acknowledgement or understanding that it's every part of the story that is not contained in the text. So I was sort of thinking, not that we are comparing ourselves in any way with Charles Schulz, but we are all cartoonists. So I thought, one of the things that we could really bring to the game here as we start talking more and more about this strip over the years is our own experience as cartoonists, to sort of talk to people about it from that perspective and give them kind of a behind the scenes look on how comics get created and how that might apply to Charles Schulz. So I actually just wanted to start with Michael. Michael, you have fairly recently completed a major project, Tangled River, which how long did you work on that web strip?
6 years.
6 years. And it has been collected in books, which you can buy as we speak, and you should as soon as this podcast is over. So to give just the basic, the roughest conceivable outline of this, it's about a young woman, a teenage girl named Tanya. She is artistically minded. She is also the living on a space colony, a colony of Earth in deep space, where for some mysterious reason, everything stopped working. That's the basic setup of Tangled River. So Michael, before you started on this 6-year journey to write this story, can you talk a little bit about how you created your main character? Because I see Charles Schulz taking Charlie Brown in a number of different ways that he seems to be sort of feeling some things out without a real plan. But you had a 6-year book coming up, and I believe you wrote a script for it. But can you tell us a little bit about how you created that main character?
Well, I spent a lot of time just getting up the courage to start working on this huge project, because I was determined. My previous work often just ended. One time with the collaboration when I moved to the other side of the country and we just stopped. So I was determined to finish something, you know, a very long project. And I wasn't going to start it till I found a subject that I could deal with. And thinking in terms of an artist, too, it was important that I have a subject that I could draw, the kind of thing I could draw. I didn't feel myself suited to doing anything in the modern world, you know, just learning how to draw cars and all that had no interest to me. And that sort of brought about the thought that, well, if I did a science fiction strip, at least I wouldn't need to do serious reference on what things actually look like. But I had the character in mind for a while. And part of it was inspired by your work with Amelia and the fact that there was such a huge response to, you know, the young female character. And this was a period when, you know, girls were getting more and more into reading comics and looking for comics that were more suited to it, you know, adolescent girls. And so my first thought was, okay, I'd like to do something that would appeal to a teenage audience and keep it sort of within the boundaries of what's permissible to have in a library in terms of violence and language. So anyway, just so in order to finish it, I felt I had to plot it first. And the best way for me to plot is to just start writing and build up the story in little pieces like that. And then as questions come about and I start wondering, okay, why is this happening? Then I'd adjust the story to explain that. The character was critical because I basically wanted to have a younger teen protagonist, but I wanted to avoid what I see all the time, especially in this genre and fantasy, which is the main character has to be the hero, has to, or at least grow into a heroic figure. I wanted to try subverting that. And so thinking of a sort of an artistic person who, an artistic girl who didn't quite understand what was going on around her and reacted to things as they came along. But as the story progressed, I wanted her to become focused on a quest, but not be the hero, the one who saves everybody. I just wanted to right. see how somebody like this would react to being put into a situation where they had to, you know, step way out of their boundaries. And I was really determined not to have turn it into a hero character who suddenly transformed and is able to, you know, beat everybody up. So I think she's fairly, at the end of the story, she's older, but not essentially different.
Did you find that your plan changed over time as the story became more realized?
Yeah, well, it definitely did, especially in terms of scripting. I stuck to the plot, but I felt that as I got to know the characters, you know, they would tell me, like, no, I wouldn't do this. And so I would either contrive something to make it more reasonable that they would do it, or I just wouldn't have them do it. So, yeah, it did veer it into other directions.
Yeah, and I think that's something that people hear, oh, the character said they wouldn't do that. And I think people have a hard time understanding that. But it really is true when you're working with a character day in and day out for years on end. They do develop a life of their own in your mind. And you know when you're pushing them in directions that the character wouldn't go. One thing I think that's interesting about that in regards to Schultz is you can see in this year that we're going to discuss today, you can see instances of him basically redoing strips, not the exact punchline, but the form of the strips, but changing Charlie Brown's character completely from the person who was the wise guy and the smart mouth to the person who is being put upon.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found that really interesting where he had the dynamic he wanted. He had the overall idea, but he didn't have the right characters in the right positions. And that's clearly something, like you say, that developed only after he spent some time with the characters. He's drawn almost, you know, 1,000 strips at this point. So the characters are becoming more real for him. So yeah, it is an interesting thing to have a character change and develop over time. And we definitely get to see that, like I said, throughout this year. One of the interesting things about Peanuts is that it's, of course, a great example of the kid strip genre, which is, you know, Amelia Rules is a part of that. Things like Dennis the Menace are a part of that. But within that, it embeds one of the great Funny Animal Comics characters of all time with Snoopy, who is also a character that is growing and changing and developing over the course of the strip. And we happen to have a world-class funny animal artist on the show right now. So Harold, I wanted you to discuss, can you talk a little bit about that, what it's like working in that genre, and why would a cartoonist choose to work with an animal character instead of, let's say, just a human or something like that?
Yeah, well, early on, even as a kid, I was very sensitive to how people interpreted what I would draw, the people and personalities and the assumptions, because cartooning, in a way, is stereotyping. right? So you're boiling something down to its essence. And I would quickly became uncomfortable with creating these characters that had very specificity to them in human characters, because I was just sensitive to how people might read something that I'd put into it and said, well, are you saying that all people who look like this act like this? And I was just super sensitive to that. And I always loved the look of classic cartoons and animation style, Bugs Bunny and that sort of thing. And certainly fell in love with Snoopy at a very early age. And so, I mean, this is even before I think I had the opportunity to try to intellectualize any of this. I mean, when I was 3 years old, I was drawing a bird and a turtle. They were the two characters in my very first comics that I still have some of those things. It's fascinating trying to actually to decode them, because I'm trying to tell a story, and this is like in some cases pre being able to write. I'm drawing, but I was using animals, and I stuck with that. I never got away from using animals for that reason, because I saw a lot of people obviously using human beings, but it just hit me that if I do an animal, people are going to take the animal and anthropomorphize it in their own way. They're going to either identify with it or not, but they're less likely to identify with that character and say, well, I'm not like that character because I don't look like that character. The animal forces you to kind of take a leap and decide who you want to identify with. I guess that's what it is to me. And they obviously are very varied in shape and size. And so there's just a lot of fun things you can do with animals. And most people are willing to go with the conceit that, an animal character is something that they can read a story about and enjoy. So why not have the fullness of all the different designs you can draw? Why not have the freedom to just have people take those characters on their own merits and decide how they want to connect to them or relate to them without dealing with any of the, or at least some of the issues that come up when you are being forced to kind of type somebody by what is their socioeconomic background? What clothing are they wearing? What age are they? What race are they? All of those things kind of go away, at least a lot of them go away when you deal with animals. And so I think that's something that I just felt freer to live in, just a freer world to live in, that hopefully invites other people to live freely and pick and choose where they want to connect with the character. And it doesn't as automatically peg that character as this is like you, this is not like you.
Do you think there's a risk of creating a different type of barrier for a reader? Where
I think so.
Perhaps kid-like or something like that, kiddish?
Absolutely. And that's the other thing that, when I was creating as an adult, I really developed, I'm not the most natural artist in the world. I feel like I learned art because I loved art, but I'm not your typical artist where it came to me easily. And so when I picked and choose what I want to learn how to draw, some artists are so amazingly versatile. I mean, I was looking at Tangled River, Michael, and just seeing all of the things that you had to encounter visually with what you were doing that just blows me away. And when I try to do something, I've built up from a very small base. I'm like laying brick by brick. I learned how to draw a nose and how to draw an ear, So, over the years, I have a number of things that I've learned how to draw and learned how to see, I think, a way an artist sees, but it wasn't easy for me. So I can't easily hop over to another form very quickly, I think, as some artists might be able to. But is that a barrier? Yeah, I think so. One of the things I've also tried to do in my storylines, which makes it confusing or could create a barrier, is that I am using what you might call very cartoony styles with the characters I'm using and they're being animals, but I'm trying to kind of mix the idea of innocence and wisdom and how they can live together. And so that's like why I feel so much affinity with classic comic strips is because they were designed to go into a newspaper and appeal to a family. The idea of family entertainment dates back to this era with the newspapers, where there was something for everybody. And some artists like Schultz, I think, were going for everybody, or at least they hit everybody or almost everybody. And that just, that's amazing to me. So I'm trying to find a way to reach people where I'm speaking to something that a child would respond to, but I'm also speaking at a level that an adult might get something that someone, younger kid wouldn't. And, you know, I don't have time to explain myself to anybody, either they're relating to it or not, but certainly, you know, looking very young, I think can make people prejudge a strip and say, well, this is not for me. And or even if they just don't like the aesthetic, they feel they're past it or beyond it. There's not much I can do about that.
You know, and it's interesting because, of course, all of that ties in with Schultz as well. And I just have to say, I completely relate to what you're saying about not being a natural artist. You know, I just yeah. loved comics and wanted to do them. But I think if you look back at anything I did as a kid, no one would say, oh, he's going to be a professional cartoonist. But except that people did say that because I was in a tiny little town and they were supportive. So that was nice. But it wasn't from natural talent. And again,
they saw something.
Well, Schultz, is doing the same thing. And he is mixing very, very sophisticated concepts and thoughts and dialogues with very simple and iconic characters. And people like Scott McCloud have talked about this sort of thing. I'm sure we'll go into that at some later date. But it's interesting to me, and I hope interesting to our listeners, how much consideration goes into something which seems unbelievably simple and should seem simple. It should seem playful and fun. If they're thinking about all the thought you put into it, you sort of failed.
Yeah, it's like, was it Chuck Jones said, it's basically creating cartoons is hard work and love, and the trick is to not let the hard work show.
Right.
I think that's true.
Oh, one of the Monty Python guys said something to the effect of, it takes a lot of intelligence, planning, and forethought to dress someone up in a suit of armor with a rubber chicken.
That's true.
So thank you for indulging me in this conversation, just because I really, if we can do anything, I want to, you know, highlight the idea that this is first and foremost a magnificent act of cartooning, an incredible accomplishment that does somehow achieve a universality. And I thought if maybe we could talk about our own processes a little bit, it might shed light onto the types of things Schultz was considering. So thanks for indulging me on that. Hey, let's go right into it now. Let's just talk about 1953. Michael, what can we expect in the Peanuts world of 1953?
Well, there's continual evolution. We saw in 1952 a big breakthrough in the fact that he introduced two of his main characters. And I think most people would agree that the A-list of the 50s and 60s would be Charlie Brown, Snoopy, Linus, and Lucy. I don't know if anybody else is in contention.
No, and frankly, in the very last strip Schultz wrote, those were the characters he named.
Yeah.
Charlie Brown, Snoopy, Linus, and Lucy.
Yeah. And then, you know, lots of B-list characters and some characters who kind of fade in and fade out. But I guess the big thing in 1952 is two of those characters were introduced. So that's like half his main cast are introduced within 6 months of each other. And both of them are very different from how we mostly remember them. But you see over the course of the year that, you see the seeds of what they're going to become later. And, of course, that continues in 53. 53 is a year there's no new characters. But the evolution continues not as much. I think 52 is more of a breakthrough year for Schultz.
I agree with that. I felt like 52 is a quantum leap, and this feels like incremental growth.
Yeah, and it is incremental growth. I think the percentage of really home run strips is higher. And doesn't seem to be too many detours into, you know, bad idea, Charlie.
Right.
Don't do that.
We teased a little bit the golf tournament, but it turns out that's actually next year.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there's a few clunkers, but basically it's just the brilliance of the concepts is so high. And I am someone who doesn't laugh out loud very much. And I'd read these hundreds of times. I mean, I started reading these this particular year, probably in around 1956, and read those books over and over again. But there's plenty of these that I just laughed out loud, even though I've read these jokes time and time again.
So how old were you, Michael, if you don't mind my asking, when you were first engaging with these strips?
Well, I'm not positive, but I think it would be around 6 or 7.
Okay.
So basically, when we get to 1953, we've got those four characters we just mentioned, and we still have Shermie, who is one of the original characters, and he's kind of a walk-on every now and then with no development. And then we have Schroeder, who quickly goes from being a baby to being Schroeder at the piano. He doesn't seem to have any in between from getting his piano to being able to play anything on it, on his toy piano. So Schroeder gets pretty fully developed within 1952. So when we start 53, we have Patty and Violet, who often work as a team to make Charlie Brown feel as bad as they possibly can make him. We have Snoopy, who is starting to seem a little more human, or much more human. He seems to know what's going on, and he's far more than a puppy. And even a couple of hints that he actually belongs to somebody, rather than just being the dog on the street. He seems to, I mean, I don't know if it's clear that he belongs to Charlie Brown, but.
No, but there are hints that, like you say, he's somebody's.
Yeah. And then we have Linus, who is very much a baby at this point. He's not really talking yet. He's not really having thoughts yet that we can see. Lucy has moved up from being kind of a baby in the beginning of 1952 to the fuss budget we know and love. So some of these relationships are solidifying. And
it seems like if I were to put ages on them, and we get hints on that from Schultz, and it does shift, right? I mean,
yeah,
these ages shift. But I would say this year, Linus he goes from being a newborn to maybe a little past one. He's starting to walk. Schroeder is, I think they refer to him as being three. There's just some oblique reference there. And Lucy Lucy's like three or four because she's going to nursery school now. Charlie Brown initially was younger than Patty and Violet and Shermie. I don't know if he's there is a strip in this year that mentions that Charlie Brown has 12 more years of schooling to go. So I'm assuming maybe he's kindergarten or first grade, and Patty, Violet and Shermie, you're probably first grade at this point. But that's just my guess. They're on tricycles, so maybe they all go back to five.
He definitely does play fast and loose with the ages throughout the whole strip. One of the things, and this goes back to what I was asking Michael at the beginning, why do you think a character like Shermie doesn't get anything? But why did he, rather than Shermie is the first person that speaks in Peanuts. Why didn't he put some of the stuff that eventually go into other characters? Why didn't he develop Shermie first? I don't know why that is, and I sort of wonder.
I have no idea either.
Because it could have been Shermie played the piano, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like he had an idea of who Shermie was. I don't know if he pegged him to somebody he knew in real life, or if there was something about that person just being very level-headed, very even, steady kind of character, didn't have a lot of meanness in him, or, you know, didn't have a lot of insecurity. And Schultz didn't really have much to do with that character, although he does fall back pretty often this year. I mean, Shermie's around for some more generic kind of presence.
He might have felt he needed a straight man to maybe set up the jokes.
But here's a really interesting question. Why on earth is Schroeder the catcher? Why is it Shermie the catcher? What, Schroeder's into Beethoven. What's he doing on the ball field? And he's like 3 years old. So I never quite figured that out. Why was it because Schroeder would be, I guess, would be more likely to beat around the bush or lie to Charlie Brown or think something in one moment because he's kind of hot-headed and judgmental occasionally, that, you know, maybe again, that just was not Shermie in Schultz's mind. And so he needed a Schroeder who was a little more oblique, a little more quirky, and had a little edge to him. I don't know.
It's possible Schultz was kind of jamming at this point. In other words, just following his instincts and not overthinking it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do think that's true. And the other, it could be a commercial consideration in that he feels, as we'll talk in depth at some point about the 12 devices that he believes made Peanuts a success. And one of them is Schroeder's music. So maybe he's just thinking, oh, this is a marquee player. This is why we have to find a place for him on the baseball team. What's interesting about, I love baseball. I grew to love baseball more as an adult. I was a terrible baseball player as a kid. So it sort of hampered my enjoyment of the sport. I favored basketball, but I've grown to love baseball. Catcher is the most difficult position physically, and it's the one where you're most likely to have injury to your hands, which is a really weird thing for the piano player,
right,
to play. And so you can either look into that or not. I don't know, but it sort of makes me think.
Well, that's right. And Schultz obviously knows that. He played a lot of informal baseball. He had no leagues when he was growing up. So all the kids had to make their own teams and then go around challenging neighborhoods. And he obviously is aware of this. There's actually a gag this year where Snoopy keeps following Charlie Brown around at the baseball game. It turns out because Charlie Brown, to pad his mitt a little more, he's put a slice of white bread.
Yeah, and I have to say, I really do relate to the baseball strips. I played Little League baseball. I played all the way up to high school. But in Little League, I was once in a game where in the third inning, we were losing 32-3. And they would not call the game. We had to play for the fifth inning. So, all right. So anything else we want to say in general about 1953 before we get into this?
I'd like to just, again, paint a little bit of a picture of where Charles Schultz is right now in his life. Right. So he was strip obviously started in 1950, and he got married in 1950, got a baby girl in the bargain of Meredith, and then Joyce and Charles Schultz had a baby in February of 1952, Monty. And then less than a year later, January 22nd, 1953, this year, just at the very beginning of where we're seeing these strips, there's a third child in the household. It's Craig. So this is this whole year that we're seeing of these strips, he's a father of three in a very quick period of time. As we'd mentioned before, they had lived initially in Colorado Springs, having known each other in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. They moved back to Minneapolis-St. Paul. I think they moved twice last year. So he's been through a tremendous amount of change in his life, Schultz has. And the other thing that I don't think we specifically called out, but I think this is the coolest thing. Just as he needed in Colorado Springs a little office to work out of, because he could not do it in the home with all of the children, he had to go off and do his own thing from the very beginning. When he goes back to Minneapolis-St. Paul, he is offered the penthouse of the art instruction schools. So can you imagine Schultz this year while he's drawing, and it's probably continuing on for a number of years afterward, he is in the top floor of the art instruction schools. I don't know that he's a celebrity at this point among them, but he's probably getting there because he's a working comic strip artist. And a lot of these people are working artists who are moonlighting with the instructions that they're doing. But not only is he in this really cool space, which must make him feel great, you know, have a lovely place to do the strips, but right downstairs are all of his old friends from art instruction schools. And I believe he still is he still doing some work with art instruction in these early years to kind of supplement his income? Is he still grading things? I don't know, but for sure he's hanging out with these friends and going to lunch with them regularly, who are artists, who are cartoonists, who are illustrators.
I believe they did keep him on and were sort of at this, even this early, kind of using him as a promotional thing, you know, where they could say, look, we have some national syndicated cartoonists. So I'm sure it was good for them to give him that space and kind of keep him around.
And it must be good for Schultz to have this sense of accomplishment that look what he's accomplished. He set out to do this. He's accomplishing it. He's doing it. It's growing. He's being published in comic books and in paperbacks. And he's getting some recognition right out of the bat with this strip that he so wanted to do. And as I mentioned the previous year, when he came back, he also got plugged back into the church that he had been started. And he was in some sort of lay leadership and teaching like Bible studies. And there's stories of him inviting people over, guests who were visiting the church who were actually staying in this house full of three children. And inviting people to Thanksgiving dinners and these sort of things, where you kind of get this picture that Schultz is probably about as social as he's ever going to be in this period. And it's so early on in the strip, but I think you kind of see that feeling as there's this kind of vibrancy of the characters. And even Charlie Brown, if we're going to relate him to Schultz, that Charlie Brown is holding his own. I think the strips this year, Michael, you probably would concur with me on this, Schultz is opening up a little bit more and more often. You're hearing of characters being depressed or angry or struggling. And Schultz is willing to put that into the strip in ways that are very unique for the comics. But at the same time, the characters to a person all are strong personalities.
Well, you know, you're talking about the depression thing, which it really does clearly become one of the great themes this year. And talking about the changing nature of the characters, Charlie Brown also, you can look at a lot of strips this year and go, oh, well, that's why no one likes you, Charlie Brown. You know, I mean, you shoved Violet off her tricycle and you did all this stuff. I mean, he's an angry little kid. And depression is something I've dealt with my whole life. And one way depression manifests itself is anger. You know, people think
anger is never a root cause. There's always something 100%.
So, you know, I don't know that Schultz was cognizant of this on a conscious level, but it certainly does make sense for the character. And I think it almost, if you really want to like go down a rabbit hole about it, Charlie Brown is clearly at heart a good person, and he doesn't want to have the anger, right? So that falls away. And he's left with just this sort of dull melancholy that follows him through the rest of the strip. And I think it's really poignant when you look at it that way.
Yeah.
All right. So how about we leave our preamble there and we get right into talking about the strips of 1953 when we come back from this quick break. Hey, we are back with Unpacking Peanuts, and we are going to talk about 1953 in detail, where we look at our favorite, some historic, some funny, some interesting, and some wonky strips by Charles M. Schultz from the comic strip masterpiece, Peanuts. All right, here we go. January 6th, we see Shermie and Charlie Brown outside in their winter clothes. Sound effects come from off panel. Clump, 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 clump. What's that? Asks Shermie. It sounds like a herd of elephants, says Charlie Brown, or a tank battalion. Shermie looks panicked. They're coming towards us. So is Charlie Brown. We're trapped. Clump, 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 clump. We see Patty and Violet walking by. Their shoes are what's making the noise. And Shermie says, every winter, it's the same thing. Girls in stadium boots. Now, I picked this obviously because I love a good stadium boots gag.
Who doesn't?
I don't know what a stadium boot is. But what struck me when I was looking about this, I'm a big proponent of hand lettering. And if you're following along, and you can follow along at gocomics.com, they have a strip called Peanuts Begins, or you can check out the Fantagraphics books, which completely collects the entire run of Peanuts from 1950 to 2000. But anyway, on this third panel, what struck me as odd about this is pure cartooning. you think of these panels as each panel containing a single moment, right? And then you one panel contains a moment, then you move to the next panel. But in here, in this one panel, we see two word balloons. So the two characters are talking and answering each other, several sound effects, which there's really no indication that they're sound effects. They're just different lettering. We don't see where the source of that sound is. And he makes this into this little composition. I just found that really interesting from the art of cartooning, in that there's no traditional setting. There's no camera angles that are important. And it sort of even breaks the rules of what can be contained in one panel. But it does it really elegantly. And I just thought it was a beautiful job of cartooning and lettering.
Yeah, I would say 1953, the first half of 1953, is Charles Schulz at his most designy ever for Peanuts. This is like where he is putting in a lot of time to get a precise line. You see it in the sound effects. He does not make it easy for himself on his clomps and clumps, where he does a very thin outline and has to run it up against itself to complete a letter as a sound effect. I mean, he's doing something that shows how steady a hand he has and how good he is with his tools. But what's going to be interesting, and I'll bring it up as we go further in, this is, to me, the peak of Schulz's really clean, precise, designy Peanuts. And it's only less than 2 years into the strip. He then moves into something that's looser and freer and faster.
Yeah, and I think that coincides with him having more responsibilities, both in his family life, but also the success of the strip brings him on a bunch of things that he didn't have to deal with before. Even just selecting the strips for the paperbacks, or, you know, fielding offers as they start to come in pretty short order for licensing things and commercials.
I think that's true. This is total conjecture, but I'm just wondering, he must be talking about these strips with these fellow artists at the art instruction schools. And I'm wondering if they're having conversations about cleanness of line versus looseness versus, you know, if some of that's part of his process, is he's actually, you know, deciding not only for expediency, but, you know, what's the right look for this? Should I be spending so much time on these strips, even not as a matter of just necessity, but maybe as a matter of choice?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and then also factor in, he's now seen hundreds of these reprinted in the newspaper.
Right.
So he knows what works and what doesn't work. And that's going to affect it too.
Yeah. And that one little shaky line that he drew, when he sees it mangled by a newspaper press, he's like, okay, maybe I don't need to be so crisp on that.
Right, 100%. You know, talking about his tools too, this is something that we as cartoonists probably don't think much about, but, you know, for kids who are doing work today, it's universally almost digital. And we're talking about a guy who, with a piece of paper and the four panels already ruled off on them, would sit with just a regular number two pencil, and then would actually use a dip pen to ink it in. It was two dip pens, one for the line work and one for the lettering. It's technology that a monk would understand from, you know, the 1600s. January 9th. Lucy approaches Charlie Brown with a book and says, "Will you read me this story, Charlie Brown?" "What? Oh, great Scott," says Charlie Brown. "Why do you always bother me?" "Once upon a time, there were three bears, and they went for a walk in the woods, and a girl came along, and she fell asleep in the little bear's bed, and the three bears came home, and the girl ran away to the inn." "Thanks for nothing," says Lucy. So the reason I pick this is because this is a terrible example of lettering, and one that I myself have done, and I've seen many really great letterers do this. The reason I read it so quickly, if you're following along, you can see, to convey the fact that Charlie Brown was reading the book fast and he just wanted to blow through it so he could go back to his life and not read this to Lucy, all the words are smushed together to convey the notion of speed. The problem is, it actually slows the reader down, giving the opposite effect of what is intended.
Really? Nope. That's how you read it?
To me, oh yeah. And like I said, I've done this. And I've seen it done in Cerebus, who's he's one of the greatest letterers of all time. It's been done in Pogo, you know, great letterers. To me, it aesthetically and visually sort of conveys it, but I think it slows you down when you're reading it, which is the opposite of what Charlie Brown is doing.
Oh, wow. I never thought of it that way. It totally works for me on both levels.
I think it works for me because I'm not actually going to read it. That's too much trouble.
That one word that has 87 letters is just a little bit much. that's a really interesting thing. So you did it, and then after the fact, Jim, you thought, did you get feedback, or was just a later kind of epiphany? This really isn't working.
Yeah, it was just a later epiphany. This didn't work. You know, and I sort of feel bad about it because I kind of knew it wasn't working when I did it, but I was like, well, I can't think. So if any cartoonists out there are listening and they have a really good way of conveying someone talking fast that isn't just smushing all the letters together.
Yeah. And any non-cartoonists, let us know if you have the same experience as Jim, that it kind of ruined the gag for you, or did you like the fact that Schultz was using that visual joke of removing all of the spaces between the words. One thing I will, again, super designy strip. Charlie Brown's head is about as perfect as you're ever going to see. That's like the perfect Charlie Brown drawing in panel 4 here. It's just amazingly clean. Just a mastery of, I can't imagine being able to hit the perfect circle of Charlie Brown's head every single time. And this, I'm just in awe of this beautiful little designy Charlie Brown in panel 4 here. It's crazy. He's also doing really fancy, clean things with the little word balloons. He's making these beautiful curves and arcs around the lettering that I just think is beautiful, but must have caused him quite a bit of extra time to live up to that every day.
Yeah, I mean, it is very difficult to draw Charlie Brown's head. And, you know, to do it with a dip pen and some India ink heightens the level of difficulty. And it seems silly to say, because it doesn't look like Rip Kirby, or it doesn't look like Hart or Julia Jones. But boy, Charles Schultz can draw.
Yeah.
January 18th. Linus is crawling on all fours after a little ball in his living room. He picks the ball up and plays with it, whistling a little tune. We hear a voice from off panel. Say, what happened to my new red ball? Have you seen it, Charlie Brown? Maybe it's in the next room. I'll go look. Linus very nervously clutches the red ball. Charlie Brown walks in and says, well, sure enough, here it is. I'll just take it. Linus looks very protective of the ball. He turns and growls at Charlie Brown. Grr, spit, growl, snap, grr. Charlie Brown walks away. I was mistaken, Lucy. There's no ball in this room. No, sir.
Yeah, it's a couple of strange things. Linus, throughout the strip, I don't think he's ever portrayed as being angry and mean, like when he's growling at Charlie Brown here.
That drawing of him growling is terrifying.
It's terrifying. Yeah. In panel 5, looking at this, this is a proto blanket, I think. I mean, that's a picture of insecurity.
Wow, yeah. Yeah. I mean, to me, this whole year of Linus is the character who is continually frustrated in his attempts to do what he wants to do. He's being frustrated by other characters who will sit in front of him in the television set. And he's unable to communicate. And he's frustrated that he can't communicate his wants and needs, and they're being overlooked. And I really feel for this. This Linus is very insecure, and my heart goes out to him. But he also has an angry streak to him for sure. I mean, he will yell at somebody because they're not getting what he's all about.
January 23rd, Charlie Brown is outside speaking with Patty and Violet. Violet says, can you come to our party on Monday, Charlie Brown? Charlie Brown answers, Monday? Sure, I can be there Monday. Patty says, how about if we had it Tuesday? Charlie Brown thinks, no, I couldn't be there if you had it Tuesday. Violet says to Patty, that settles it then. As they walk away, Violet says, We'll have our party on Tuesday.
This is the third iteration of the gag. The gag being the two girls sound like they want to invite him to a party, but then they find an excuse not to.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They're going out of their way, not just to have the party without him, but to make sure he knows that he is not welcome.
And to do a variation on the theme over and over again on him.
Right. Right. Which again, you know, and I've said this millions of times, the crazy cat influence. I obviously Schultz is looking for scenarios that he can go back to again, and which is something you have to do on a daily strip. Yeah, I mean, a few people, like let's say Gary Larson aside, you're really coming up with a finite number of things that you're returning to over and over.
One thing he's doing this year, but it's not till later in the year that he starts doing them sequentially. So the gag might be extended over the whole week. Variations right. on it. Right now, it's like, you know, might have been a month or who knows, 5 months since the last time he pulled this little gag here. But the strip evolves to more of these thematic, weekly thematic things later. I mean, if Snoopy gets weed claustrophobia, it's going to be every day that week, a different variant on the joke.
Right. Right. That is true. January 26th, Patty and Violet are talking while they play with dolls. Violet says, "When you get married, you have to change your name, don't you?" Patty says, "Yes, I guess you do." Violet says, "Mrs. Charlie Brown." She stands up and contemplates it further. "Mrs. Good Old Charlie Brown." "Nope, I just can't see it."
Again, this is Violet playing, at least thinking about the wife. Being, which, you know, they're 4 years old, but we're positing that she is sort of the stand-in for Schultz's first wife, Joyce.
And by we, you mean you.
We meaning me. Yes. That's exactly right.
All right.
All right. January 27th, I just wanted to mention is Lucy and Schroeder, where Lucy kind of sees Schroeder as a love interest. She's sitting at the piano, has become so famous in later years. And she's saying, "What is that you're playing, Schroeder?" Schroeder says, "This is the Waltz of the Flowers, Lucy. It's from the Nutcracker Suite." And she walks away with a little aura around her and a big smile. "Sweet. He called me sweet. I've never been so happy in all my life."
I love that one.
That I think that's the first time we've ever seen Lucy seeing Schroeder that way. So I just wanted to mention that one because that's a major first that we'll see many, many times again in the course of the strip.
Not sure if that comes before or after, but there is a thing where she says, "This is the 23rd time I've seen Schroeder. Do you believe in love at 23rd sight?" So I'm not sure. After this.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing that, but it could have been before.
January 28th, Violet is walking with something under her arm. She says, "As long as I've got a new box of stationery, I'd better write some letters." She sits at a table where she's starting to write. She turns and looks at Charlie Brown and says, "Do you have an eraser, Charlie Brown?" Charlie Brown, who's reading a book, says, "No, that's something I've never felt the need of." He continues, "You see, it's all a matter of proper planning. People like myself, who never make mistakes." In panel four, Violet hits him over the head with her box of stationery.
Which lifts her off the ground.
See, this is why nobody likes you, Charlie Brown.
this is why Charlie Brown in these early strips is different than the later Charlie Brown. Because one of his qualities, he's kind of a braggart. And he talks about himself all the time. He thinks he's perfect. Which... Yeah. Is not later Charlie Brown. And I mean,
he has that beaten out of
him. But this is so common. I mean, people do this all the time. I would never do that because I always am modest and defer to other people and let them talk. I would not dominate the conversation and talk about myself all the time.
Well, I guess we're alike in that way, Michael. I mean, self-effacing is something that I find to be really is one of my greatest strengths.
I think I'm fabulous. February 1st, Patty and Lucy are walking down the street. Patty says, "Let's walk up to the dime store, Lucy, and look at all the toys." They continue walking. Patty says, "I think it's a lot of fun, even if you can't buy anything." They're in the drugstore now, and Patty is looking at the toys, but Lucy's too short. She can't see anything above the counter. Patty says, "Look here, Lucy, look at all the little dolls." Lucy says, "All I can see is the front of the counter." Patty continues, "Look over here, look at the tiny dishes." Lucy, staring straight into the counter, says, "I must say, they're putting good wood into them these days." Patty says, "Gee, and look over here." Lucy continues to admire the counter. "Nice and smooth, too. Good job of sanding." Patty says, "Look at all the paper dolls, and look at those toy boats." Lucy continues, "I see they use screws instead of nails. That's a good idea." Patty points at more toys. "Here's some tiny airplanes, and there's a tiny fire engine." They've now left and are walking home, and Patty says, "We'll have to do that again sometime, huh, Lucy?" Lucy says, "Sure. Call for me again in about 4 years."
This is such a classic. What's interesting is that...
This is one of my favorite from the whole 50 years.
Yeah.
I've always loved it.
Yeah. And the thing is, the punchline is not the funniest part. The punchline is like the middle bunch of panels where Lucy's not complaining. She's making the best of the situation and admiring the wood.
Yes.
It
doesn't look like she's being sarcastic while she's actually spending all this time looking at the wood in front of her instead of the toys.
No, she doesn't. No.
Higher. It's beautifully drawn.
Yeah, it's always been a favorite of mine. I think it might be the best drawn Peanut strip. I think it's gorgeous.
And for those of you at home who are not seeing this, they are in a little store, and Schultz is selective in what he shows us. There are these angled shots where we can see what Patty's seeing, where she's seeing toy soldiers and tanks and little miniature buildings. It's almost like they're in a railroad, you know, HO railroad type store. But it's just a lot of detail and picket fencing, which is going at angles that we don't always see in later Schultz strips. Beautiful trees. I mean, it just has loads and loads of really nicely placed detail, and the overall strip just has a gorgeous feel to it. And this is peak Schultz clean design era.
I love all it, because it's the illusion of detail. I mean, you're not really seeing all that much, but it feels like you're seeing hundreds of little action figures and little toy soldiers and stuff like that. Now, have you guys any experience with actual 5 and 10 stores? For 5 and dimes?
We, of course.
Yeah, I had my Woolworths experience. I remember buying wacky packages for 5 cents. That was a huge deal as a really little kid, 7, 8 years old.
Yeah, we had a Woolworths too. Downstairs was the toys. But we also had, a 5 and 10 store in Ashland, Pennsylvania, all the way up into the 2000s. And in the 2000s, you could go and buy greeting cards that Robert Crumb worked on at American Greetings in the early 60s. Wow.
Oh my gosh.
You could buy toothpaste that had expired in the 90s.
Stores like that.
Oh, it was crazy. And they would bring out all like their Christmas decorations and stuff. It would be like those molded popcorn plastic looking things and stuff. And then they'd sell two of them. And then they'd go back in for a year. And then they'd come back out the next year.
I have such great memories. We were driving in Missouri in some rural area, bait and tackle store. And this is probably in the night around 1980, 84 or so. And we stop into this place and just things that had not been touched, you know, for years on the shelves.
Yeah.
And there was a jar of Dippity Doo, which was a hair gel for teenage girls. That had a brownie camera offer that expired December 31st, 1959. And that to me was just the coolest thing.
That's amazing.
So that's the fate of the 5 and dime stores. The one thing that does not totally work for me in this otherwise amazing strip is that it looks like Lucy is genuinely speaking about the quality of the wood and the sanding and the screws and then instead of nails. That she's genuinely making the best of this experience where that's all she can see. And I can't tell if Schultz changes her attitude in the final panel or if she's been just so incredibly good deadpan that she's being sarcastic without any sense that she's actually being sarcastic in the rest of the strip. But I wasn't expecting her to have an attitude about call me again in about 4 years.
Oh, see, little, the attitude.
Little furrowed brow.
That's the part that makes it for me. Because whether she is putting on her best face during the thing, but it is also sarcastic. It's not binary, you know.
It's bofum, as we like to say.
Exactly. And the other thing, I love that Lucy knows so much about woodworking. That is just awesome.
That's great.
February 14th, Charlie Brown and Patty are sitting on a little bench. Charlie Brown is forlorn. He says, "Nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. I didn't get a single Valentine, not one." Patty says, "That's awful, Charlie Brown. Here, how do you like this?" She hands him a little piece of paper. Charlie Brown says, "For me? Oh boy, wow." He holds up the Valentine Patty gave him. "This is something, a real Valentine." Patty says, "Don't take it too seriously. I'm just loaning it to you so you won't feel bad."
Well, as someone who never got Valentines, this one breaks my heart. Aww. I want everybody to feel sorry for me.
Aww. Well, yeah, I went to Catholic school, and the rule was if you brought one kid a Valentine, you had to bring everybody a Valentine.
That was my public school experience, and boy, yeah, I do not have fond memories of the buying the box of 30 to match every classroom you were happened to be in.
Oh.
and having to sign your name. And if there was anybody you did want to do something special with, it certainly wasn't going to show very easily in the in that 30 pack. It was assorted general statements in beautiful oversaturated colors.
By the way, assorted general statements would be the greatest name for a Valentine's company. Just I find you adequate.
You'll do.
Right. You know, the other thing looking about the, I mean, not to get off the Valentine's theme, but I really notice in these strips, the first panel, a chunk of the real estate was cut out for the word peanuts. The title was in the upper left-hand corner of every one of these strips. So sometimes he has to kind of, you know, work around that to where he places the word balloons.
Yet another indignity for Charles Schultz that he has no room to work in, and they're carving out a chunk of the upper left-hand corner, which is super important in the strip.
Yeah, probably the most important, the upper left-hand corner of the first panel where you would expect the words to be. The other thing is, I believe if you look at the Sunday strips, that also occurs on the second tier of the Sunday strips. Like we were talking in the other episodes where they would remove the top tier sometimes. If you look starting at that second tier, there's always a negative space in that upper left-hand corner. So I guess the people that wanted to cut that first strip off also were cutting that top tier off, we're also cutting the title out. So they would be able to strip it in there.
So essentially what some people saw in that space, or maybe most people saw, was like a negative, like a white peanuts on a black rectangle in the upper left-hand corner. Because I remember seeing that in the strips that I was reading. Now in the Fantagraphics version, I think the version that's online, they've removed that. But that's an element of peanuts that I remember as a newspaper experience, is you had this little design icon of that peanuts in the upper left-hand corner. What's odd to me is that it's not, why wouldn't it have just universally been done? I guess because because often they would put the title above the strip in a lot of the newspapers, and they didn't want to have the redundance of it. So I guess you could get it both ways as photostats. If you were a newspaper, you get, you know, a week or two daily strips and you paste them in, and you probably had your choice of which version you would put in based on how the paper decided to use its space and whether they were going to give credits above and outside of the strip.
Well, and also it would all universally, if you're doing it on the comics page, it would have been named above it. None of the other strips were doing this. The reason there's the title on this one is because, again, it was sold as a space saver. A lot of times it was on, you know, the women's page or the ad page. In the Pottsville Republican, which was one of the two papers I grew up with, it was on the editorial page. And in those instances, the title had to be a part of the artwork.
Because otherwise it just would look awkward, especially if it was being done vertically. I guess you wouldn't have much space.
Space at all, right? Exactly.
Yeah. Wow, that's rough. I feel for Charles Schulz on that one.
Tons of restrictions put on him, and they were reproduced so small, but he makes every millimeter count. February 18th, Lucy comes up to Charlie Brown and says, "Charlie Brown, will you make me a sandwich?" Charlie Brown is indignant. "What? Good grief, Lucy, you're going to drive me crazy. What a nuisance." He's pounding on the ground in frustration. "Don't you think I've got anything else to do? Why do you always bother me?" Lucy calmly asks, "Are you through?" "Yes, I guess so." "What kind of sandwich do you want?"
Yeah, the frustrations of fatherhood, right?
Yeah.
Just kind of coming
He's
out
He's used
here.
This joke a lot, but it was Lucy in the Charlie Brown plays. You will see some of these coming up where Lucy will go into a rage, and then the last panel, she'll just, after getting it out of her system, she'll just say, "Okay."
All right. Robert Short, who is an author who goes on to write the books Gospel According to Peanuts and The Parables of Peanuts, talks about how Schulz repeats poses for their iconic and emotional value again and again and again throughout the strip. And one of the ones that he really focused on is this panel 3 of the character pounding the ground in anguish. And I think that might be the first time we've seen it. It's certainly
maybe
struck me like that.
Yeah. And that's also odd because it's to my eye, it's drawn a little bit high in the panel compared to where you would normally put that, or the average artist would have dropped him a little bit down so that the ground was closer to the bottom of the panel. Mm-hmm. Do your eyes see that, or does that not register?
No, that yeah, that does register for me that way.
And I don't know why. I don't know why he would have done that, but it certainly makes that panel stand out more than I think it, even if it would have
right.
done the way maybe more artists might have made the space, even out.
Yeah. The other thing is he's experimenting again with lettering. He's using the jagged kind of burst word balloon, which is, stereotypically used in comics to denote shouting. He doesn't really do that very much later. He relies on the size and the boldness of the words within the balloon to convey that. And this one, he's even using a serif font because he's going into, again, his Dan Klaus period, doing a little serif lettering. I don't know how well any of that works, but
it's definitely very designy. I mean, again, that clean design, this is to me another example of the amazing clean design on a strip.
And where we were going, we were just talking about the real detail in the Sunday strip. This one has no backgrounds whatsoever, just a little line indicating the ground here and there.
Right.
February 19th. Lucy is listening to a record. The record is playing and singing Georgie Porgy, Puddin' in Pie, kissed the girls and made them cry. When the boys came out to play, Georgie Porgy ran away. Lucy takes the record off the turntable and says, "What an erotic he must have been."
One of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, that is pure peanut. It's also the one that the cartoonist Seth, who designs all the Peanuts books for Fantagraphics, it's the one he selected for the back cover of this volume. I can't imagine there's too many instances where neurotic was used in a comic strip before this.
Certainly not out of a kid's mouth.
Well, I can't imagine it coming out of Popeye's
mouth. Well,
either,
maybe
really.
Mary Worth or something.
This might as well be, we might as well announce it. We're also starting a second podcast, Misunderstanding Mary Worth, where we are going to take a shallow dive into the 100 years of Mary Worth strips.
Yeah, subtitled, What Price Mary?
We'll have more with Jimmy, Michael, and Harold as Unpacking Peanuts continues in 1953, Part 2. Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
You blockhead!